This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
News, I'm Dave Packard. President Trump arrived in Malaysia today for a summit with Southeast Asian leaders. It's part of a multi-day tour that includes a meeting with China's president in South Korea later this week. ABC's Selena Wang is traveling with the president.
Throughout the weekend, U.S. and Chinese officials have been negotiating, trying to hash out all the details, setting the stage for a productive meeting between these two leaders. It will be their first face-to-face meeting in 6 years, the first for President Trump's second term. And Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, he said that the two sides made substantial progress.
Authorities in France say they've arrested two suspects in connection to the heist of priceless crown jewels from the Louvre Museum. DNA at the scene matching one of the suspects. At least two more suspects remain at large. Jamaica is already experiencing tropical storm conditions as Hurricane Melissa lurches across the eastern Caribbean. It's headed directly toward the island. Current sustained winds now at 140 miles per hour. This is ABC News. A deadly mass shooting during homecoming at Pennsylvania's Lincoln University, about 45 miles southwest of Philadelphia. At least one person dead, six others injured when gunfire erupted following a football game at one of the oldest HBCUs in the country. So far, authorities don't believe the shooting was a planned mass shooting. The FBI now assisting authorities. Hundreds more ICE officers being deployed nationwide. That update Friday from Secretary Kristi Noem at St. Paul, Minnesota, where she said since January, agents across the region arrested more than 4,300 people with criminal records in the U.S. illegally.
Under the Trump administration, our president has been focused on protecting American citizens, on making America safe again.
Then today, a man who Virginia investigators say was fleeing ICE agents was killed when he attempted to cross an interstate in Norfolk when he was hit by a pickup truck. The victim, identified as 24-year-old Jose Castro Rivera of Honduras, investigators say he exited his car, attempted to cross Interstate 264 when he was struck. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
A very funny stand-up comic, Mr. Mike Toomey. The last time I saw a Goldie Hawn film in the theater, the male lead was giving her a foot massage, and it was the worst foot I've ever seen. I actually said out loud, I went, ew. And my aunt started cracking up.
Yeah, maybe they could have had a stand-in, like a stunt foot.
Or please, something. Even if it's a guy's foot, I don't care.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Over the air and on the web, WRCE is your home for real news and great conversations through Richland Center. Learn more at WRCE.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. It's spooky season, and that means kids all over Wisconsin are trick-or-treating. Lisa Hale has some safety information for families.
I think when we talk about safety in general, every year somewhere in the country, there tends to be some sort of concern about candy. Now, is it happening everywhere? No.
That's Lieutenant Megan Cash, the Public Information and Community Resources Officer with the Appleton Police Department. To stay safe and for peace of mind, Cash says there are steps parents and kids can take to ensure their candy and other treats are safe.
Wait till you get home looking through that candy. Know where you're going trick-or-treating. Understand some of those concerns can still exist, but more of that concern is about just like making sure things aren't unwrapped.
Cash said when choosing a costume, to avoid long trailing fabric that can be a tripping hazard. If your child is wearing a mask, make sure the eye holes are large enough for them to see clearly, or forgo the mask completely and use makeup instead. Give trick-or-treaters flashlights or glow sticks to help them see better, and so drivers can see the little monsters, ghosts, witches, and Power Rangers better.
Trying to maintain that visibility is really important. But let's say you are going as a group, staying in that group, making sure that when you're moving in that group, that you're staying on the sidewalks. Crossing the road safely is really important. You know, looking both ways.
Check with your local municipality for trick-or-treating days and times. And as you prepare for the spooky night, make it less scary by using safety tricks that make treats even better. I'm Lisa Hale, Civic Media News.
And I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. This is Civic Media News.
Real news, great conversation, right to your inbox. Subscribe to WRCE's newsletter and never miss the stories right here in Richland Center.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mainly sunny for today, a high in the low 60s. A mostly clear sky tonight, low in the mid-30s. And more sun on Monday, a high near 60. After that, rain chances return for Monday night, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Right now, it's 61.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Dustin Mack from Appleton's History Museum at the Castle. We talk Wisconsin Dells ghost boat tours, and musician Strategic joins me in studio. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are addressing, as we have in the past, will in the future, the legitimacy, the illegitimacy of these prosecutions, at least as to two of the three recently indicted adversaries of the president. We have talked already about James Comey, Letitia James, also now talking about John Bolton, and why that particular prosecution against him partakes of something different than the others, because, in fact, it may be premised upon some credible reason to believe that he may, in fact, have committed a crime and yet may be subject to dismissal. Why? Because of the statements that the president has made in the public domain condemning John Bolton. And yes, indeed, John Bolton has written about the president, said things in the same ilk that have been very critical of the president. It has gone in both directions. The concern, of course, is you have the chief executive involving himself in an area that other presidents in contemporary history have not become involved in. This has been the norm, that is the separation between the Department of Justice and the White House ever since Watergate. It is the abuses of Watergate that we are now seeing again, where a chief executive wakes up in the morning and says, I want my adversaries prosecuted. And when the officials in the Department of Justice, and we've seen that in connection with at least one of those departing United States attorneys, refuses to do that, that person is fired and a new person is placed in. And that person, that new U.S. attorney, then returns the very indictment that the president wants. That procedural history in these cases involving James Comey and Letitia James looms large, and is, in fact, a part of the kinds of things that the judges in those cases will necessarily undertake to determine whether or not the cases can go forward. The other part of this, of course, has to do with the authority of the U.S. attorney there in Eastern Virginia to prosecute. John Bolton's case in another district, in the District of Maryland, different prosecutor, different U.S. attorney, different history, a longer investigation, and an investigation that included a search of his own home, and presumably based upon review and analysis by career prosecutors, career investigators who know what they're doing. Again, not to presume that John Bolton is guilty, but just to indicate that he is now lumped in. He is in the same pot with these others for whom there is very little reason to believe that the prosecution is premised upon anything other than vindictiveness and animus. And if indeed John Bolton's prosecution is also dismissed, what you are now opening the door to is the dismissal of cases that are legitimate. And that's not good for the justice system either. And it underscores once again the problem with any president, including this president, engaging in the kind of trouncing on the separation that has always existed until Donald Trump became president between the Department of Justice and the White House. There is more coming up here, and we know as well that the president has identified other people on his list, so to speak, who might also be the subject of similarly vindictive prosecutions in the federal courts in the future if he can convince, once again, U.S. attorneys in the appropriate districts to return those indictments by presenting some evidence before grand juries. We know those people include, arguably, Christopher Wray, another former FBI director, Fonnie Willis, the Fulton County DA who prosecuted that major omnibus RICO case against Donald Trump. We know as well that Adam Schiff has run afoul of the president, and likewise an investigation presumably afoot with respect to him. Another case may be involving mortgage fraud once again. George Soros on that list, others presumably as well. And this practice will repeat itself. Again, whether there is legitimacy to the underlying charges or not, each one of these people identified by the president in the public domain as among his adversaries can then raise these credible and not frivolous motions that they themselves are the targets and the subjects and the victims of vindictive prosecution by your Department of Justice. Necessary to continue to monitor what happens, watching very carefully what the judges do with these all-important motions in these cases, and watching, of course, if they decide to deny those motions, speedy trials in all these cases sometime probably in early 2026, if not before. All of that happening again in the federal district courts of America, at least up until now, in Eastern Virginia and the District of Maryland. Let's move to another area of a presidential power that is properly allocated to this president and to any president since the time of our Constitution's writing. You know well that Section 2 of Article 2 of the Constitution, Article 2, of course, is the portion of our Constitution that invests in a chief executive all the powers of the presidency. And it includes in Section 2 the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. And the reason why that language from the pen of James Madison and George Mason and others is so important is because it's one of the very few aspects of the Constitution that is completely unchecked. There is no check against the pardon authority. The president, this president, prior presidents have pardoned all sorts of people without any check, no legislative check, no judicial check. And that's because the founders wanted it to be that way. They wanted this to be a matter of pure grace, pure mercy by a president who it will not be second-guessed by any other branch of government. And the presumption was that the chief executive would do this out of mercy. Over the years, these standards have evolved to establish inside the Department of Justice, inside the Office of the Pardon Attorney, the concept that typically one is not entitled to a pardon or commutation of a sentence, that is, reduction of the sentence. Absent a period of times, typically at least 5 years since the conclusion of the sentence, the criminal judgment imposed upon the defendant, and then some showing that there's something about that person's life, something about their engagement in the community, something about their making their family, their community better in some way, themselves better in some way, that makes it clear that they have put that criminal behavior of theirs behind them. They admit it, they acknowledge it, and there's something about their life in its exact illustration and demonstration to the pardon attorney that shows clearly that they're entitled to a pardon. It has been abused, undeniably. There are presidents in both parties who have gotten a lot of criticism for exercising this unchecked authority in ways that the public does not like. And yet, it is there. And that's the way that our Constitution reads. We know that just in recent days, this president has invoked Section 2 of Article 2 of the Constitution in two ways. Let's talk about those two. You have heard about both of them. One has to do with former Representative George Santos of New York. He was that disgraced fabulist. This fellow was making up all kinds of stories, all kinds of lies that made him the target, the focus of, frankly, national, maybe even international scorn, and engaged in all sorts of fraud that landed him ultimately with a judgment, a sentence of conviction, more than 7 years in prison. He was charged in particular with a huge amount of aggravated identity theft and wire fraud. He was required to pay $370,000 in court-ordered restitution to his victims. And again, until very recently, he was serving the first few months of his 87-month sentence. That's a little more than 7 years in federal prison. The president has recently commuted his sentence, C-O-M-M-U-T-E-D. That's the verb. That's the noun. The commutation is the noun. And the president has done that because, in his view, these are the words of the president, George has been in solitary confinement for long stretches of time and by all accounts has been horribly mistreated. Therefore, I just signed a commutation releasing George Santos from prison. And then he goes on to say, immediately, all capital letters, good luck, George. Have a great life. The president in other settings has also acknowledged, as have other members of the White House, that the president was on the receiving end of petitions by George Santos to get the very commutation that he has now received. Mr. Trump, the president, earlier on had acknowledged that George Santos, as a part of his fraud, his defrauding all of these people, he said he lied like hell. And he also said, I don't know him, but he was 100% for Trump. And apparently that's the basis upon which this president has now commuted the sentence of George Santos, basically releasing him from prison and also removing from him the obligation to pay back any of this restitution to the many victims who are out there. George Santos saying, in response to whether or not he will still make good on at least that portion of his sentence, saying, I'll do whatever the law says, but plainly, with this commutation, this reduction in sentence, no longer obliged to do that. When he was indicted back in 2023, prosecutors had accused him of multiple criminal schemes. They ranged from everything from fraudulently claiming unemployment benefits, lying on official forms, using his political campaign to enrich himself, swindling money from donors for personal expenses, using one donor's credit card to steal $11,000 for his personal use. It goes on and on and on. The defendant also, of course, boasted about extensive Wall Street experience. He talked about his mother, who had been in the World Trade Center on September 11th, claimed to be a college volleyball star. All those lies, none of that necessarily in violation of federal law, but he also became the first person in history to be expelled from the House of Representatives without being convicted previously up to that time of a federal crime or somehow supporting the Confederacy. This fellow has an extensive background, and it is in the wake of that, that the president has commuted, meaning not pardoned, not erased the sentence, but has reduced the sentence to time served. And George Santos, now released from prison, as the president said, immediately, no longer subject to his 7-year term of imprisonment, and no longer obliged to pay the several hundred thousands of dollars to his victims of his crimes as a result of that commutation. The deceit and the criminal conduct well established, and George Santos acknowledging that in court, a plea accepted by the federal district court judge, basically not wiped from the annals of this prosecution. It's still there. This particular commutation is unlike a pardon. It does not remove the record of this, but it does remove George Santos from federal custody. That happening at the pen of this president just this past week. The president has also exercised his pardon power, basically to remove from the annals, from the records of criminal prosecution, a criminal conviction of a man named Changpeng Zhao, Changpeng Zhao. He is referred to as CZ. He is the richest man in crypto negotiation and in movement of cryptocurrency around the globe. The cryptocurrency exchange that he himself put together is called Binance, B-I-N-A-N-C-E, and as a part of a long-standing investigation there, CZ was identified, he was charged, ultimately convicted of money laundering, violations that allowed terrorists and other criminals to move money onto Binance and otherwise engage in conduct plainly in violation of federal law. It was the world's largest exchange. Interestingly, what the president said about this was what CZ did wasn't a crime. When we come back, I'll tell you exactly what CZ did in fact do, what the federal court sentenced him for, and what the effect of this pardon by this president under the Constitution is here on Amicus, a law review.
From the center, WRCE.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
They were it. That's the ballgame.
Adrian Klenz is executive director of the Center for Deafblind Persons. Those cuts, those programs would be rolled into something else. Is there a group deafblind children could be folded into?
There is no other program. Those seven individuals have the specialized training to help those with dual sensory loss. There's no one else in the state of Wisconsin that has that training.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
I was stuck in a state of panic and endless rituals, so I made the call.
Mental health care works when you make the call. Visit mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Civic Media.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review, talking about the latest exercise by a president, a chief executive of his, perhaps one day her, unfettered, unchecked authority to issue commutations and pardons under the Constitution of the United States of America. Commuting, this president has the 7+ sentence of George Santos, that disgraced congressman, who was identified and ultimately pled guilty to a variety of identity theft and wire fraud charges. He is now free. And as a result of the commutation of the president, he is no longer in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons and presumably no longer has to pay the $370,000 in monies, in restitution funds that the court ordered that he pay to the victims of his criminal conduct. And then we have the pardon. This is an out-and-out pardon. This is a decision by the president to effectively erase, not from history, it's still out there, but from the official records of criminal prosecutions in the United States, the prosecution and, yes, the conviction upon a plea of guilty. Didn't go to trial, pled guilty to a huge amount of money laundering violations that allowed terrorists and other criminals to move money onto Binance. The defendant in this case, Changpeng Zhao, known as CZ, he himself has a very interesting history. He founded Binance in 2017. It is to this day the largest and the most influential crypto exchange currency operation in the world, processes as much as about 2/3 Of all the digital currency transactions on the face of the planet, customers can buy and sell and hold popular cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ether. Zhao himself, the most powerful executive in the entire crypto industry. He's worth an estimated $85 billion, $85 billion with a B. Social media commands that in ways big and small, and otherwise has been one of the major movers when it comes to cryptocurrency in the international transactions and on the face of the planet. We know that as a result of his conduct, he drew the attention of federal authorities. And he, in the end, after this extensive investigation, as he was moving toward trial, he pled guilty. In particular, Mr. Zhao, who again is a Chinese-born executive, he now lives in the United Arab Emirates. He admitted that he had violated the federal law, our federal law, by failing to install some very rigorous compliance systems required by law at Binance, that his company, his corporation. You might say, well, gee, that doesn't sound all that serious. But the problem with that is that by doing that, by knowingly failing to do that, what did he do? That allowed people in countries that are subject to the sanctions of our nation and terrorist groups like Hamas, like Al-Qaeda, like the Islamic State, ISIL or ISIS, and others to move money on his platform, supporting the kinds of activities in which those terrorist groups engage. And that's the reason why this prosecution was so very, very important. When he pleaded guilty, Zhao, who goes again by CZ, that's how he's referred to in the public domain, stepped down as the chief executive of Binance, and he remained the majority shareholder and held on to virtually all of his wealth. The important aspect of this is he acknowledged in federal court, in open court, that indeed that's exactly what he did. He admitted to doing this major series of crimes, and the judge accepted that plea based upon the presentation of evidence at the sentencing, at the change of plea hearing, and at the sentencing as well. Mr. Zhao then sentenced to prison, and as a result of his four-month prison sentence, he finishes that up, and he is released even before the pardon goes into effect. The pardon effectively lifts any sort of impediment for Mr. Zhao going forward, including anything that would attempt someone who's otherwise guilty and has been adjudged guilty of a federal felony. Even in the context of some other pardons, this one is fairly extraordinary. And indeed, the backlash in response to this is notable. An economics professor at Cornell University said this is yet another example of the administration's brazen flouting of the rule of law. There is little justification for this pardon and highlights how far this administration will go to promote the cryptocurrency industry. Others have likewise been very, very critical of this. On the other hand, Caroline Leavitt, who is, of course, the White House press secretary, said in a statement just this past week that President Trump exercised his constitutional authority by issuing a pardon for Mr. Zhao, who was prosecuted by the Biden administration in their war on cryptocurrency. She went on to say the Biden administration's war on crypto is now over. And indeed, we know now, and as we look more into this, as the media does, that this is also an example of how some high-profile business partners of Donald Trump and his family have benefited from his rollback of some wide-ranging crypto crackdown efforts that were initiated by Joe Biden. To seek this pardon, Zhao hired some lawyers and some lobbyists. And who were they? They had some ties to the Trump administration. While Binance itself struck a very lucrative and a good business deal for Binance with a thing called World Liberty Financial. And that group, World Liberty Financial, is the Trump family's crypto startup. The connections to the Trump family and to Donald Trump himself cannot be overstated. And that deal alone, that arrangement that accomplished this pardon in the end, likely to generate tens of millions of dollars a year for the Trump family. And the family of a fellow named Steve Witkoff, W-I-T-K-O-F-F, who's the president's top
Middle East advisor. The connections inside the administration, the things that we now know about that prompted this pardon, troubling indeed. The Office of the Pardon Attorney would otherwise have looked at this, made a determination after all of this was settled, after Mr. Zha was long, long released from prison, and made a recommendation about whether there was something that merited this. Here the president intervenes, issues his pardon, which he has the right to do, and accomplishes the complete pardon of CZ, the richest man in crypto, who admitted to this major money laundering violation scheme during the course of his recent activity.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
Don't miss any of the stories that impact your life. Catch WRCE's News Roundup in podcast form. Go to WRCE.fm to subscribe.
News, I'm Dave Packard. President Trump arrived in Malaysia today for a summit with Southeast Asian leaders. It's part of a multi-day tour that includes a meeting with China's president in South Korea later this week. ABC's Selena Wang is traveling with the president.
Throughout the weekend, U.S. and Chinese officials have been negotiating, trying to hash out all the details, setting the stage for a productive meeting between these two leaders. It will be their first face-to-face meeting in 6 years, the first for President Trump's second term. And Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, he said that the two sides made substantial progress.
Authorities in France say they've arrested two suspects in connection to the heist of priceless crown jewels from the Louvre Museum. DNA at the scene matching one of the suspects. At least two more suspects remain at large. Jamaica is already experiencing tropical storm conditions as Hurricane Melissa lurches across the eastern Caribbean. It's headed directly toward the island. Current sustained winds now at 140 miles per hour. This is ABC News.
Reminiscing with Rodgers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports. In the lead-up to the Sunday night football game between the Packers and Steelers, I had a chance to ask Aaron Rodgers about a funny photo of him in the back of a red pickup truck holding up a case of beer on their way back to the stadium one day. He talked about that and his days in the golf cart with David Bakhtiari.
You got unmuted, Mike.
What was happening that day? And talk about some of those times that maybe weren't so public.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember exactly whose vehicle that was, but there was like a bunch of cases of beer in the back. So, you know, you guys would always take that walk back. And whether I was riding in the back of a truck or riding on that silly golf cart that D-Bog gave me, we were always messing around, having a good time. Those are some of the shenanigans and pranks. It got so crazy, some of the pranks they were pulling, that Mike at one point said, you know, cut that shit out, no more of that stuff, because they were doing some wild stuff.
That's Aaron Rodgers with Sports on Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Halloween creeps ever closer, and all the streaming platforms are well aware you might be in search of some good jump scares. Last week, TheWrap.com gave us some scary movies on HBO, and now they're sharing some Hulu offerings, which include The Fly, starring Jeff Goldblum. This 1986 film pulled a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes and is positively disgusting and wonderful. If you want to be scared and laugh a bit, check out Scream. And for those of you who are true masochists, there is the positively disgusting Saw for your streaming Halloween pleasure. I think we are officially out of ideas to watch based on what is gaining traction right now in people's living rooms. The 2010 action comedy The A-Team is finding new eyes after its Netflix release. The film was based on the 1980s TV show with George Peppard and Mr. T. The cast is led by Liam Neeson, who shares the screen with Bradley Cooper, Jessica Biel, and Rampage Jackson. He'll never be Mr. T. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
From Main Street to the Capitol in Madison, WRCE is where Wisconsin turns for real news and great conversation. WRCE.fm.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mainly sunny for today, a high in the low 60s. A mostly clear sky tonight, low in the mid 30s. And more sun on Monday, a high near 60. After that, rain chances return for Monday night, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Right now it's 61.
Hey there, Wisconsin. Tom Hartman here. Democracy is not a spectator sport, so join me each and every weekday right here on Civic Media for the Tom Hartman program from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Covering the news of the day and sharing ways for you to get off the sidelines and get active in your community, because change starts with you. Get involved and tune in to the Tom Hartman program Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. right here on your local Civic Media radio station.
This is Robert Pilot, host of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we talk about Native issues like treaties, protecting Mother Earth, and holding our elected officials accountable. You'll also hear from Turtle Island voices like Arvina Martin, State Representative Heather Keeler, Ruth Anna Buffalo, Dr. Anthony Stately, State Senator Mary Kunish, Robert Lilligren, and Bob Blake. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll look back at the weekend sports and news headlines. Also be joined by our friend and colleague, Jane Matinair of Matinair on Air. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We're now turning to more exercises of government authority, chief executive authority, the tension between constitutional commissions of power and authority, congressional conveyances of authority, and exercises of executive authority by this president. We're talking now in this segment of our broadcast about, yes, once again, the National Guard. We have spent a lot of time on this issue for two principal reasons. One of them is that it is an awful lot about the power, the authority of a president, and the checks and balances that the Constitution and the laws of our nation set up, not to prevent the president from engaging in the due administration of the laws as the Constitution requires him to do, but to ensure that when he does that, it is premised upon the law and upon the facts and an application of the law to the facts and the facts to the law. We know what has been happening around the country. We have spent some time in previous broadcasts talking about the various situations in places like Memphis and Washington, D.C., and yes, Los Angeles, and in particular, Portland, Oregon, and Chicago, Illinois. We're going to focus most of our attention now upon those last two cities, Chicago, Illinois, and Portland, Oregon. Chicago, a place once again identified by the president as a place where he would like to deploy the National Guard to restore peace, to restore the kind of calm and safety and security that he feels is not present there, to address what he has described as a place of not just a lack of safety and security, but also a place that necessarily needs imposition of more law enforcement than what the local authorities require and have asked for, what the governor himself has said is not needed. And that is one of the principal tensions that we see in all of these cases involving the president's description of various cities as being in dire need of the intervention of the National Guard, and local authorities saying, yes, indeed, we have problems, but we can handle those on our own. And I should say at the outset, as we launch into this discussion about what's going on both legally and practically in Chicago and also in Portland, that this is much related to but different from other issues that we've discussed, and that is having to do with the work and the mission and the deployment of ICE agents. We're going to talk about that in other settings in the future. Right now, talking about the National Guard, this decision to federalize the National Guard over the opposition of the state governors, contrary to their interests and contrary to the specific requests that they have made to the president not to do this. Let's talk first about Chicago. We know in that case that a federal district court judge named April Perry, she is a trial court judge, had hearings on this, made the determination in the end, as we have described in the past in great detail, that in fact there is no insurrection. There is no rebellion, to use the word of the applicable statute, going on in Chicago. And she acknowledges that there have been not only disruptions, there have been things that are violent in nature, and that those are not to be tolerated, and that those people who engage in the violent behavior there should, in fact, and are being prosecuted by local authorities for that conduct. But she says, as do the other judges who have addressed these issues, that those particular events do not partake of a rebellion. That is an effort to overthrow the government,
the entire nation of government in the United States of America. And for that reason, the president's invocation of the Insurrection Act and his identification of this as being a rebellious city is simply unfounded. Therefore, what did she do? She said not only should the National Guard not come into the city, but they should be disbanded, at least as to this Chicago initiative of the president. Goes up to the Seventh Circuit. And we know from our discussion of this just last radio broadcast that the Seventh Circuit agreed with her wholeheartedly and said, yes, indeed, there is no basis to believe, even though there have been these disruptions in the local safety and security, the peace of the community has been disrupted to some extent, but also noting that those are the kinds of things that come, frankly, in a free society that should be responded to by law enforcement with prosecutions and convictions, but not partaking once again of a rebellion, of an insurrection that warrants this kind of dramatic response. Well, we know that in the wake of that Seventh Circuit decision, again, by a panel of Seventh Circuit judges, that the Solicitor General of the United States of America, his name, John Sauer, asked for review of that Seventh Circuit opinion, plainly in opposition to what the president wants, seeking to lift that order that blocked the deployment of the National Guard in Chicago. John Sauer, again, the Solicitor General, said that the lower court intervention, as he said, countermands the exercise of the president's commander-in-chief authority and projects its own authority into the military chain of command, basically saying federal district court judges have no business doing this. The administration contends that the president has unreviewable discretion. Let me say that again. The administration contends that the president, in its application for review by the Supreme Court, says that the president, the chief executive, has unreviewable discretion to do this, and that federal district court judges and the federal appellate court, in this case, the Seventh Circuit, should stay out of this. Opposing that, of course, arguing to the Supreme Court, is, of course, the lawyers for Illinois and the city of Chicago. They told the justices this. They said that state and local law enforcement officers have handled these isolated protest activities in Illinois, and there is no credible evidence to the contrary, very much mirroring exactly what Judge Perry found, what the Seventh Circuit also found. The state of Illinois lawyers and the city of Chicago lawyers said that the state seeks to protect its sovereignty. Yes, indeed, a state's rights issue here. Retain control over local policing and protect the basic structure of American federalism from unprecedented intrusion. Again, they're all premising this upon the order from April Perry that said that the National Guard has no business being there. And in that order, she cast doubt on the federal government's credibility. She said, we do not doubt that there have been these acts of vandalism, civil disobedience, even assaults, but the court cannot conclude that the government, declarations by the government are reliable. And so, National Guard, no permission to enter into the city. That is the position of not only the federal district court, which is the premise for the appeal to the Supreme Court, but also, again, the position of the lawyers who are defending the state and local law enforcement as well. Opposed by the Department of Justice, representing the White House, arguably representing America. That's what the Solicitor General of the United States is supposed to do. The Supreme Court has now before it this issue of whether or not the Seventh Circuit's opinion, its order, supporting the notion that there's no rebellion going on in Chicago, acknowledging that there should be other law enforcement activities to address these problems, whether that should be overturned. Again, we wait probably in the next few days for a decision by the Supreme Court on what they will do with these petitions, with these arguments to overturn what the Seventh Circuit has done right here in our circuit in a Midwestern city. Let's talk about Portland. Paralleling this in many ways, we know there another federal district court judge, we know this from our previous discussion of these events, her name is Karen Immergut, and she issued orders just like April Perry did. She looked around and she said, based upon the evidence presented to her in a trial in front of her, she said, you know what, there's just no support for this notion that Portland is up for grabs and that because of a rebellion and insurrection going on here, it is necessary that the president overrule the governor of Oregon and direct the entry into the city of Portland of the National Guard. She made the same kind of finding the federal district court judge made in Chicago. Here, interestingly, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals came down in a different direction. Initially, suspending, if you will, a part of her order, but ultimately in a three-judge panel saying that deployment can in fact move forward for now under this preliminary ruling. The legal wrangling, however, continues, and while that appellate ruling from the Ninth Circuit, very different from the Seventh Circuit decision, lifted that block, that restriction that was imposed by Judge Immergut, the deployment of Oregon soldiers there in Portland, it was not immediately clear about the extent to which it allowed the president to use National Guard soldiers from other states, as he had suggested he might do. That remains a somewhat unresolved issue. But it's very clear right now that a lot of things are going on in the Ninth Circuit because in the wake of that divided opinion, two judges said, yes, indeed, the lower court judge is wrong about this. And there is, in fact, a sufficient basis to order the National Guard to go in. A third judge looked at this and she said, you must be joking. She said that today's decision by the other two judges on the panel is not merely absurd. She said it erodes core constitutional principles. The judges who supported the decision to go in, they wrote this. Their names are Bridget Bade and Ryan Nelson. They cited some instances in the record in which they said demonstrators in Portland, for example, attempted to set fires in a building. They threw rocks and sticks. They threatened some officers with knives. They shined lights in some officers' eyes, and they shot paintballs at officers. And it's based upon those kinds of things that they came to the conclusion, contrary to the lower court judge, that indeed there is something partaking of rebellion in Portland, Oregon. Therefore, they said, even if the president may exaggerate the extent of the problem on social media, it does not change the fact, these two judges said, that provide a colorable basis to support his decision to use National Guard soldiers. So we've got a split, but the 2-1 majority effectively permits the president to go ahead with this. What happens in the wake of that is lawyers for Oregon, the city of Portland, immediately asked the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit for what's known as an en banc hearing. That's Latin once again for let's get all the judges together. Let's have all the judges review this decision by three of them and determine whether they're right or wrong. That's an appeal before the Chief Circuit Judge and 10 randomly selected judges among the entire group there. And the Ninth Circuit has already solicited from the parties some information about whether they should go ahead and do that en banc hearing. We are waiting in the midst of all of that negotiation and that review and that deliberation to determine whether or not the Ninth Circuit will pursue that en banc review of the decision by the three-judge panel. In the meantime, there is a second temporary restraining order that was issued by Judge Immergut, which covered all federalized National Guard troops, not just those from Oregon, and that's still in effect, but probably not for very long. The Ninth Circuit judges wrote in their order that they believe that the two restraining orders rise and fall together, and federal lawyers asked Judge Immergut recently to stay and remove the second. So we've got a lot of things going on in the Ninth Circuit, and we'll see exactly what it is that the Ninth Circuit does. It is entirely possible that that case also, depending upon what an en banc panel does, if the en banc panel is convened, that case could also end up in the Supreme Court. There may be different circumstances. There may be facts between the Chicago case and the Portland case that differentiate them. But fundamentally, both cases focus upon how one interprets these kinds of things in the street. Different interpretations, same law, leading to different conclusions by federal judges. When we come back, we'll talk more about that, and then we'll talk about yet another exercise of executive authority here on Amicus, a Law Review.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Football season is heating up on Prize Picks. Now, you and I make decisions every day, but on Prize Picks, being right can get you paid. So keep the season rolling by getting $50 instantly in lineups when you play your first $5. Plus, the app for Prize Picks is really simple to use. Just pick two or more players across any sport, pick more or less in their projections, and if you're right, you could win big. Prize Picks is also available in 40-plus states, including California, Texas, Florida, and Georgia. Most importantly, they don't play about your money. All transactions on the app are fast, safe, and secure. Don't miss any of the action this season with Prize Picks, where it's good to be right. Download the Prize Picks app today, use code SUNDAY, and get $50 instantly in lineups when you play $5. That's code SUNDAY on Prize Picks to get $50 instantly in lineups when you play $5. Win or lose, you'll get $50 in lineups just for playing, guaranteed. Prize Picks, it's good to be right. Must be present in certain states. Visit prizepicks.com for restrictions and details.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation just announced the official start date for one of its biggest ever construction projects, the I-94 East-West Project, which will reconstruct and widen a 3.5-mile stretch of interstate highway in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. This is a massive project with an estimated cost of more than $1.7 billion. And with this official start date announced, also came estimates for how long this will take. Construction is expected to last until 2030. At the Recombobulation Area, this project is something we've covered extensively, including with an award-winning four-part series called Expanding the Divide. It might be worth revisiting that series and considering how unnecessary and expensive an extra lane is and how in southeastern Wisconsin, we're going to be dealing with construction and delays for the next 8 years in order to shave a few minutes off suburban commute times while the city streets and city problems go ignored once again.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
Seems like nobody in America agrees on much of anything these days.
But can we agree the federal government shouldn't tax people into poverty?
If you work full-time, you should be able to afford your basic needs. Don't you think? We're the Patriotic Millionaires.
We believe your full-time job should cover what it costs to live. We think your first $45,000 of income should be tax-free.
And multimillionaires?
We should pay more to fund your tax cut. Go to first45taxfree.com to learn more. A working-class tax cut paid for by millionaires. That's an idea we can all agree on.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
The incomparable Jane Mattner.
I have been in radio for 44 years.
It's incredible.
I wanted to be an actress originally. Radio to me was mind theater. Mm-hmm. I could be anybody.
Yeah.
And people could imagine it. It's like reading a book mm-hmm. instead of the movie. Is your mind gets to fill in lots of details. And I think that's part of the genuine experience of radio.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local civic media radio station. And on the app, as Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This is the final segment of our two-hour broadcast this weekend, talking all about exercises of executive authority, presidential authority to issue pardons, to engage in deployments of the National Guard, to direct the Department of Justice to prosecute his adversaries, and yes, indeed, now also to direct the Department of Defense to attack Venezuelan and Colombia boats in the oceans, both the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean. We know what this story is all about. The United States of America has attacked now, according to most recent account, 10 different boats, killing about 43 different people as a result of these warlike activities on these boats. And that is the point. The president indicating that he has justified these boat attacks as a matter of self-defense at a time of high overdose deaths in the United States of America. They have focused their rhetoric on the attacks on these boats at the high seas, on Venezuela in particular. The administration also, as late as recent days and even recent hours, indicating that it may pursue a land strike or a targeted operation against the country's president, whose name again is Nicolas Maduro. And of course, he is also an adversary of the president in the international market, the international scheme. We have reporting, of course, that the U.S. is even deploying some aircraft carrier to Latin America as the drug operations expand. Venezuela's Maduro saying that the United States is fabricating a war after it deployed this huge warship and also pursuing the continued destruction, the attacking of these various boats. The real question is, of course, are these attacks legal? Are they a part of the president's authority, or are they something other? A broad range of specialists in these cases dispute whether or not the president has the authority to do this. Traditionally, it's always been the case when it comes to interdiction of boats. The president maintains that these boats are carrying drugs to America. Traditionally, historically, how we've dealt with that is through maritime drug smuggling operations, countering those as a law enforcement matter, not a military matter, where you engage in attacks, violent, warlike behavior. And that has included usually the Coast Guard interdictions, sometimes with the involvement of the United States Navy. This is plainly different. And although we have been able to do that with some success, that is interdicting similar boats in the past, the Trump administration here asserts that these killings of these people in these boats is legal. And again, as a matter of self-defense, he has described the people who are bringing these drugs into our nation as drug cartels, deemed them terrorist organizations. And he has said that he is determined, found that as a matter of fact, that the United States is now in a formal armed conflict with them, these drug cartels. We are at war, basically. And the question, once again, is whether that is the case or not. We know that the War Powers Resolution, which is this Vietnam-era law that attempted to rein in the authority of presidents to do these kinds of things, says the presidents do have some authority here, but they have to end deployments in congressionally unauthorized hostilities after 60 days. And of course, the big issue is that it's under the Constitution that it is in Article 1 that the Congress declares war and not the president. The president here is saying that he is determined that we are at war and therefore can take this action by virtue of his factual finding about what is going on. Question whether that is an overreach under the Constitution and under the War Powers Resolution. We know as well that the law permits the president to carry out some limited strikes in the national interests. National concerns warrant that, as long as the anticipated nature or the duration or the scope of that falls somewhat short of a true full-blown war in the constitutional sense. The question is whether or not this falls in that category or is a true war of the sort that the president cannot properly authorize, cannot do these things by virtue of his own determination. And there is a fair amount of congressional pushback on this. We know that Senator Todd Young, who's from Indiana, particularly upset with the Trump administration about these ongoing strikes against alleged drug boats off the coast of South America. Senator Young has accused the Trump administration of deliberately keeping lawmakers in the dark about the strikes and reiterated that the authority to declare war lies with the Congress rather than the president, invoking both this constitutional argument and also saying, Mr. President, we don't know if your determination falls within the law, the Constitution, because you're not telling us what is going on. He says this: if there's been any takeaway from me from the last roughly 25 years of congressional action and inaction, it's not that Congress needs to be more hands-off. It's that Congress needs to get out of the way, he said. I think Congress needs to go further. Rather than just asserting our ability to authorize military force, which we certainly need to do, we also need to officially bring to close these conflicts and make clear that we have constitutional prerogatives that need to be consistently asserted. And again, all of these remarks echoed by others with increasing ferocity, increasing clarity on Capitol Hill, certainly from Democrats and an increasing number of Republicans who are concerned about this president's overreach under the law, under the Constitution, wondering out loud whether this kind of thing that is involving the death of human beings is involving a compromise in our status in the international community, arguably bringing us closer to perhaps a real war with Venezuela,
and in violation of some of our fundamental principles about how we engage in the international community in the rule of law. Like all of these other issues affecting all of us in the area of presidential authority, we'll continue to focus on these, we'll continue to discuss them, and we'll take all of this up again next weekend when Amicus Law Review continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Have a good weekend, everybody.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Jamaica bracing for a major hurricane. Melissa exploded into a Category 4 overnight. The dangerous storm bearing down on the island, which is already getting tropical storm conditions. Jamaica's Minister for Water, Matthew Samuda, urging the nation's residents to stay calm as they get ready for the storm.
It is time to complete your preparations. It is time for some prayer. And it is time for us to plan and time for us to engage our programs.
Police in France say they've arrested two suspects connected to the heist of priceless historic jewels from the Louvre Museum. DNA at the scene matching one of the arrested suspects. President Trump arrived in Malaysia today for a summit with Southeast Asian leaders. The multi-day tour includes a meeting with China's president and South Korea later this week. A big screen adaptation of the popular anime Chainsaw Man beats a biopic about the boss and the horror sequel Black Phone 2 to top the weekend box office. This is ABC News.